Cohen. Geraldine Brooks' new novel, Caleb's Crossing, is set on Martha's Vineyard in the 17th century. English families who wanted to get away from the authoritarian Massachusetts Bay Colony lived on that island, home to the Wampanoag Indian tribe. The narrator of the story, Bethia Mayfield, is the daughter of a Puritan minister and has a secret friendship with Caleb, the son of a local chieftain. He's inspired by the life of the first Native American to graduate from Harvard College in 1665. Geraldine Brooks is our guest on Radio Times today to talk about how she put this story together. She drew on letters, oral histories, diaries, and historical documents to write her novel. There's a surviving paper written by the real-life Caleb, and it's a report on the myth of Orpheus written in Latin. Geraldine Brooks is an Australian-born Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist, a former foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She covered conflicts in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. She's written a number of books, and she joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show. Congratulations on your book.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be back with you, Maddie.
Well, you're very welcome. And I wonder if we could begin where even you began, with the discovery of this story. It began with a map, I guess, that you looked at in Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah. We'd moved to the island, and I was interested in having Native American neighbors for the first time. I wanted to learn more about the tribe, and the tribe has a fantastic cultural and historical stewardship, and one of the documents that I got from them was a map showing all the sites of significance on the island. And on it, right near where we were then living, was a notation that it was the birthplace of Caleb Cheshtiamok, who was the first Native American graduate of Harvard.
And that's what it said on the map?
Yeah. And I thought, oh, cool. Maybe I'll run into him at the farmer's market. Because my mind wanted to read the date as 1965, because that made sense to me. It was the resurgence of Native American political action and civil rights movement. And then when I actually realized that I was looking at the number 6, as in 1665, my mind just started racing.
And that was the beginning of this story?
Yes, indeed.
There's a young woman, and I do want to have you read a section, actually the very beginning of her story. She's the narrator, Bethia Mayfield. How would you describe her?
She is the daughter of the small English settlement's minister, and she's striving to live as a good life as the Puritans saw that.
Which,
very limited view of what a woman's life should be, very circumscribed, very domestic. Women are encouraged to learn to read so that they can read their Bible. But after that, that's about it. And she is watching her father prepare her older brother to go to this Harvard College on the mainland. So her brother learns Latin and explores the classics. And she wants that. She's intellectually hungry, but she's told in no uncertain terms that these higher studies will addle her wits and make her an unfit wife, because you can't send a woman off to marry a man who's going to be able to find fault with his every argument. And so she's stifled, but she is prepared to take great risks to further her education, even though she knows it's going against what's expected of her.
You know, it reminds me of some of the current stories we read about girls in certain countries who also are not allowed to go to school, or go to school at great peril, learn things at great peril.
Well, this was really inspired by the story of a young Afghan woman who had stolen her education. She was forbidden by the Taliban to attend school. Her brother went to school at the madrasa next door, and she would climb onto the roof every day. And perched up there, she could overhear the classes in the courtyard. And when her brother would come home, she would do his homework for him.
Oh,
so Bethia is very much indebted to the example of girls like that.
Curious, determined, courageous.
And hungry. Learning. You almost can't help yourself, you know.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book. And it's narrated by Bethia Mayfield, this young girl. And this is where the story starts.
He is coming on the Lord's Day. Though my father has not seen fit to give me the news, I have the whole of it. They supposed I slept, which I might have done, as I do each night, while my father and Makepeace whisper together on the far side of the blanket that divides our chamber. Most nights I take comfort in the low murmur of their voices. But last evening, Makepeace's voice rose, urgent and anguished, before my father hushed him. I expect that was what pulled me back from sleep. My brother frowns on excessive displays of temperament. I turned on my shakedown then, and wondered in a drowsy way what it was that exercised him so. I could not hear what my father said, but then my brother's voice rose again. How can you expose Bathia in this way? Of course, once I caught my own name, that was an end to it. I was fully awake. I raised my head and strained to hear more. It was not difficult, for Makepeace could not govern his tongue, and though I could not make out my father's words at all, fragments of my brother's replies were clear. Of what matter that he prays? He is only, what is it, not yet a year, removed from paganism? And that man who long had charge of him is Satan's thrall, the most stiff-necked and dangerous of all of them, as you have said yourself often enough. My father cut in then, but Makepeace would not be hushed. Of course not, father. Nor do I question his ability. But because he has a facility for Latin, does not mean he knows the decencies required of him in a Christian home. The risk is... At that moment, Solace cried out, so I reached for her. They perceived I was awake then, and said no more. But it was enough. I wrapped up Solace, and drew her to me on the shakedown. She shaped herself against me like a nestling bird, and settled easily back to sleep. I lay awake, staring into the dark, running my hand along the rough edge of the roof beam that slanted an arm's length above my head. 5 days from now, the same roof will cover us both. Caleb is coming to live in this house.
And that's Geraldine Brooks reading from the very beginning of her new book, a novel called Caleb's Crossing. So this he that her father and her brother are talking about or even arguing about is this young Indian who's also living on Martha's Vineyard.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. And the idea of bringing an Indian into someone's house to educate them, is that a revolutionary idea?
I think it would have been reasonably unusual. I've based this novel as closely as I can on the few scant shards of fact that exist from this time period. And while it's not certain that Caleb lived with the
real
family.
Caleb,
yeah, the real Caleb and the real missionary family that I've borrowed some details from. This minister did invite Indians to his house and to his table, and so he lived quite closely with a number of the people that he managed to convert to Christianity.
What did you learn about the English families, because we're talking about the 17th century, the English families that came from the Massachusetts Bay Colony to Martha's Vineyard, where they really were a minority? There were, 3,000 Indians living on the island?
We think that there are about 3,000 Wampanoag, and perhaps as few as 20 families made the initial crossing in 1641. And I always wondered why. Why was this island settled so early when, goodness knows, it's inconvenient enough living there now? And why would you set 7 miles of really treacherous, tricky ocean currents between yourself and the mainland and anybody else like you at such a precarious time?
And what do you think the answer is?
The answer was interesting. The answer was that this group of people really wanted to get out from under the thumb of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which had become at this point rather tyrannical in its theocracy. They were quite Taliban-like in many ways. If you disagreed with them, you risked being hauled into court and possibly tortured by having your ear slit off or being cast out into the wilderness, as they notoriously did to Anne Hutchinson when she was pregnant and had 9 kids. So it was a harsh dispensation, as they would have put it. And this little group, I think, even though they were first-generation migrants from England, were, I think, prototypically American in wanting to do their own thing.
And didn't want to be told what to do, I
guess.
Yeah,
and the leader of the group bought the patents to Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket from the English lords who purported to own them. And then he sent his son to the island to negotiate with the Songkhams, or chieftains, to see if one of them would sell them some land. And one did.
What's interesting, and I guess this goes back to some of the real documents that you found, was that when they arrived on this island, they saw this tribe of Indians extremely, I guess, healthy. They were able to really thrive on what we now think of as Martha's Vineyard.
It's a very abundant place even today, but it's really noticeable in all the English writings. They're so struck by how good-looking and how tall and healthy the Wampanoag are, and also struck by the fact that they have leisure time. That they play days-long games of something that might have been football or lacrosse. It's hard to make out what it was, but it involved a ball made out of skins, and the young men would stack their weapons so there wouldn't be any altercations over the scoring, and they would run up and down South Beach, which is miles and miles of beautiful beach, playing this game. And the English, of course, were struggling to eke out a bare minimal existence because they didn't really know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. For one thing, they weren't farmers. Most of the people who came in that initial migration came for idealistic reasons, and they were pretty well-heeled and well-educated people who didn't have a lot of practical skills.
So what was that early relationship between these English settlers and the Indians?
There wasn't one at first. For about a year, there was, you know, the Indians did their thing and the English did theirs, and they were quite separate, and, you know, it wasn't so easy to get around. And then gradually, one guy who was an outcast among the Wampanoag started to hang around the English settlement, and he converted to Christianity. And that was the beginning of a great press on the part of this young minister to bring Christianity to the Wampanoag on the island.
But I can imagine, and there's a reference to pagan in that reading that you just did, that there were conflicts on so many different levels.
Yeah, you know, at one point they're admiring, you know, how well these people manage their life. On the other, they immediately say, but of course they're abandoned by God and they're in the hand of Satan and they're in a terrible, appalling condition and we have to help them. So there's a lot of, you know, conflicted thinking.
I'm curious, and we're almost up on a break here, but we hear Bathia, she's the narrator. Was there someone that you had in mind in constructing this character?
Not really. I pulled all kinds of things together because I learned, much to my astonishment, that there are no women's journals before 1700 in colonial America and no decent ones till 1750, which is a whole 100 years later, and a lot changes. So I looked at Anne Bradstreet's poetry and her letters because she's one of the few women who was educated to write and had a classical education. And I thought, well, if Bathia saw some of those poems, she would be... That would be very liberating for her to know that there were women like that.
And the Bible as well, I guess, influencing the way she might write.
Yes, indeed.
Geraldine Brooks is our guest today on Radio Time. She's got a brand new book. It's a novel called Caleb's Crossing. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We'll get another reading as well. And we'll open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. Jefferson Orthopedics helps patients with hip, knee, foot, ankle, shoulder, and spinal problems and with sports injuries and offers minimally invasive surgical procedures. Jefferson nurses and physical therapists employ post-operative rehab treatments designed to help patients resume their normal activities and lifestyle. To schedule an appointment or for further details, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine the origins of the financial crisis with Gretchen Morgenson, co-author of the new book Reckless Endangerment, how outsized ambition, greed, and corruption led to economic Armageddon. Morgenson is a financial reporter and columnist for the New York Times. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Supporting WHYY, Philadelphia Theater Company concludes its main stage season with the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ruined by Lynn Nottage. Inspired by interviews conducted in Africa, Ruined is a powerful and life-affirming story which celebrates human strength and dignity with humor and song against the backdrop of war-torn Congo. Tickets for Ruined, running May 20th through June 12th, available at 215-985-0420 or philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain talking with Geraldine Brooks about her new book called Caleb's Crossing. It's inspired by a true story and also a work of her own imagination. It's a story that's set on Martha's Vineyard, where Brooks lives today. It's about the first Indian who attended Harvard College in the mid-17th century. The story is narrated by the daughter of a Puritan minister. And we are talking about how this story came to life and some of the true history involved in this story, and obviously this work of imagination as well. Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book, and this is really where Bathia, or we meet, I guess, as readers, we meet this Caleb Indian.
He was the younger son of Nanoso, the Nocket Songkem, and his name was Chesha Teamak. In his tongue, it means something like hateful one. When he told me this, I thought my limited grasp of his language was defeating me, for what manner of people would name a child so? But when I asked if his father indeed hated him, he laughed at me. Names, he said, flow into one, like a drink of cool water, remain for a year or a season, and then maybe give way to another more apt one. Who could tell how his present name had fallen upon him? Perhaps the giver of the name had meant to trick Chi-Pi, the devil god, into thinking him unloved and therefore leaving him alone. Or perhaps it had come upon him for cause. I had found him hunting alone, he reminded me, when the practice of his clan was to hunt communally. In a band that values the commonweal above all, he chose to be Chuppy, the one who stands separate. When his band set out towards sun rising, he struck off towards sun setting. It had ever been thus, as long as he could remember. While most babes still nursed at the breast, he had weaned himself, left the women, and set about trailing after his mother's brother, Tekwamak, who was their powwow. He would hide himself under mats or in thickets to hear the incantations and witness the dances. At first, he said, his elders had berated him for lacking respect, and the name might have fallen upon him out of their feelings at that time. But Tekwamak took a different view and said that such behavior presaged his destiny, to be powwow in his turn. So he had gone to live in his uncle's Weetu, while his elder brother, Nanakoman, was like a shadow at their father's side.
And again, Geraldine Brooks reading from her new novel called Caleb's Crossing. So how much have you been able to put together of the actual Caleb's life? And we meet him here. We see what he looks like. We learn a little bit about his name, his tribe, his family. How much information is there actually about this real person?
Oh, I wish there was more. it's very frustrating how little we know about him. We know where he was born and that he was the son of the chieftain of that area. We can be pretty sure that he was first instructed by Thomas Mayhew Jr. to learn English and to read and write. He went off then with a fellow island Wampanoag named Joel Iacumis and with the son of the minister to prep schools on the mainland. And he attended the sort of final step to going to Harvard was Daniel Corlett's Latin school in Cambridge. Mm. I'm sorry, Elijah Corlett's Latin school in Cambridge, where you really perfected your Latin because all the instruction at Harvard was delivered in Latin. And we know that he completed this very rigorous, very broadly based liberal arts education, mastered Greek, probably knew Hebrew, and graduated with the elite of the Puritan colony. One of the former governor's sons was there, the preacher John Eliot's son was there, military leaders, you know, the cream of the crop. So he was part of a considerable elite.
you have included in the very beginning, I guess in the fold of the book, something, I guess, the only actual surviving document that he wrote, something in Latin, and this was the myth of Orpheus that he wrote, written in Latin.
Yeah, it's actually a kind of elaborate thank you note to the English donors who had funded his education, but it begins with a discussion of the myth of Orpheus and how Orpheus used music to charm the beasts and the trees, and it talks about the role of culture as a civilizing influence.
And Harvard at that time, Harvard College, was created to educate English and Indian youth.
Yeah, that's in the charter of 1950. So, you know, these guys, the Massachusetts
Bay... Not 1950, but...
I'm sorry,
1650.
1650.
Long, long time ago.
Yeah. That's just that odd 300 years there. You know, I'm still trying to get my head around it because I didn't grow up in the US. I grew up in Australia. So all of these events are more than 100 years before the white history of Australia even begins. And to think that these colonists had barely set their foot down, hardly had a shelter over their head, and they're planning a college. And not just any old school, but a college of high ambition. They wanted the degrees to be accepted by Oxford and Cambridge, and they were. So they had the ambition, but they didn't really have the means. So the Harvard of the 17th century was not the well-appointed, cushy place that it is today. It was a struggle to keep the place afloat, and the kids didn't have decent food. In fact, the cook was notoriously called in and asked to account for why she'd served the scholars mackerel with the guts still in them and eked out her flour supply with goat dung. So when I heard the undergrads at Harvard last year complaining that they couldn't get hot breakfasts anymore, I had to laugh.
To think about Caleb and what he had to endure.
Yeah.
Now there was an Indian
college,
so a building there,
yes.
I guess, on campus.
Yeah. So the original hall was pretty decrepit by the mid 17th century because it hadn't been built very well, and there was this brand new brick building. There had been a couple of Indian students who'd attended Harvard briefly but not really done the formal degree, and then Caleb and Joel arrived and they were the first residents of this new brick building that was very fancy for its time. And of course we know where all this was leading, which was to the bloodshed of King Philip's War, as it's called, or Metacom's Rebellion, when the leader of the Wampanoag believed that, that these English were going to take everything and looked like he was going to win the war for the first 6 months. I mean, he destroyed all the frontier settlements and burned down Providence. And it after the war, after he was defeated, relations were so embittered that any ideas of mutual projects like the Indian College were gone. But my characters don't know that. So I had to put myself back where an alternate future, a better future, is still possible.
But he has, and this is your character, Caleb, has left the Indian tribe. I mean, in a sense, he wants what the English have to offer, which is an education.
And that's not an unusual thing in Native American culture. The Tsongkhim San would often go off to another tribe to learn, if there was something that could be brought back to the betterment of his own people. So this was, it's not the same as, in Australia we have this terrible piece of history called the Stolen Generations, where kids were plucked out and taken to English schools, Australian schools, against their parents' will. I don't think that's what we're dealing with here. And one thing that I do feel fairly confident about is if he hadn't wanted to stay, he and his friend Joel, they would have left, because by then they had agency, they were mature enough, and many Indians did say it wasn't for them. But I think that these two were real intellectuals who embraced their destiny in the world of educated men.
And that's Geraldine Brooks, our guest today on Radio Time. She is, as you can probably tell, an Australian-born, but you might not know, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist. She was a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. In fact, covered conflicts in the Middle East, in Africa, and the Balkans. She's the author of a number of books. The new one is a novel, and it's called Caleb's Crossing. Any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. 77WHYY. This goes back to the novel, and in this scene, Bethiah sees Caleb, and they have I guess, a secret relationship, a secret friendship. She calls him my dearest friend. And I wonder whether you were tempted in any way to make this a romantic relationship. You don't do that. But were you tempted?
I was highly tempted.
Because I think they would have been a very interesting couple.
I thought about it long and hard, and I thought that, you know, I want to hew to the history as far as we know it, and I just thought that that would have been a bridge too far. But I also would say that this is narrated by Bethia, and does she really know her own heart in this matter? So what she says and what she felt might not be the same thing.
But they are friends. I mean, they see each other as friends.
Yeah, well, they meet each other as kids, and it's all very innocent, and they've got nothing in common. They don't have the same belief system, cosmology, ideas about how you live on the world, the ideas about what's right and what's wrong are completely at odds. They have one thing that binds them, and that is that they're both intellectually curious. They're both hungry for knowledge, and they're both willing to take huge risks to get it. And that is the source of their friendship. And that seemed very plausible to me because, you know, I can feel that hunger and how it could bring you together across all kinds of barriers.
You can feel that personally? I mean, from your own, maybe
your
own
childhood? Yeah, and also, you know, my experience as a foreign correspondent. Right. Just meeting people and feeling that no matter what their circumstances were, you recognize that kid is you. That kid is the same, you know, that they're speaking a different language, they have a different faith, but they want education more than anything.
And you could be friends, perhaps?
Oh, you are friends. Immediately, right. That is the bond, you know.
You also have these really gorgeous descriptions of what... And I guess was it called Martha's Vineyard back in the
day? It was pretty much from the get-go. Sometimes they call it Martin's Vineyard. But that could just be, you know, the spelling is all over the place in the 17th century. But that was the name given to it by the first English explorer who saw it and supposedly named it after his daughter. And because there's a lot of wild grapes there, that's where that name originated. The Wampanoag names for the island were Naopi, which means place in the water, and Kapawak, which means place of sanctuary.
Oh, wow. Well, you describe, I mean, and it's just so beautiful. And I've never been to Martha's Vineyard, but I'm wondering,
I hope you can come.
I know. I can put that on my list. But I wonder how much of that 17th century island still exists today.
Luckily, quite a bit. The island is only one-third developed, and one-third of it
by
is
design?
Not exactly. One-third of it's in conservation, which is very much by design, and a third of it's still up for grabs. So, you know, we work very hard to kind of put that land in conservation as well. But there are places. There was one place that I would often go to. It's a high point of land, and you can see from the north shore of the island to the south shore, which is about 8 miles at that point. And in that vista, there is not one man-made thing, which is remarkable. And I think that even in a year's time, that won't be true because a lot of people on the island are building windmills and we'll be able to see those. But right now, it's forest and ocean. And I used to go up there, and the trees are different because it was all logged for farming a century and a half ago. But if you squint and imagine the trees as the virgin forest, you can feel like you're walking where Bethia and Caleb walked.
Wow. And did you walk a lot as you were writing this book?
I do anyway, because my dog insists on it. But there are places, and I think the place that really drew me to the island and made me into what vineyarders call a wash ashore is the clay cliffs of Aquinnah, which are very important in Wampanoag story and tradition. And one of the most beautiful places on the planet, in my opinion.
And is that the cover of your book?
Indeed.
Are the white cliffs?
The clay cliffs. Well, every year they're different color.
Oh.
I always look forward to the first spring walk because you don't know what the winter will have uncovered. And there's white and purple and red and yellow. And when the sun is setting, it's just absolutely magical and majestic. And you feel the power of the place.
And what do they call you? A washa.
Wash ashore.
What does that mean?
It means you weren't born on the island, but you've turned up there.
And are you accepted as part of that, or are you a provisional member?
Well, you know, it's drawn such an interesting variety of people. And, you know, we still, fortunately, there are the Wampanoag who have been there forever who are not displaced from their lands. The history on the island went a little differently. And I think that, you know, part of that was to do with the reasons that the English first came there. And that's not to say there wasn't terrible dispossession and cheating and land deals and things like that. It's not a clean history by any means, but it never came to blows or bloodshed on the island. So there's the Wampanoag, but there's a million, you know, people who've been, and the original English settlers, the same names are still there. My next door neighbor is a Mayhew, which is the family I've based my minister on,
and one of the early families that came over.
The first. And so you see all these old names from the mid 17th century, and then our newest community are Brazilian immigrants. So, you know, it's a very diverse place, and of course, a long African American history too, because it was a stop on the Underground Railroad, the Wampanoag, Capawack, the place of sanctuary. They would take in people who jumped ship, and so
The slave ships.
Well, from whaling ships, who were enslaved, if they knew if they could get to Martha's Vineyard, the Wampanoag would hide them.
There also is one of the, maybe it's the father in this story, talks about bringing Christianity to the salvages, S-A-L-V-A-G-E-S.
It's a very important word, I think. I love to get the words right. I want to use the words that they would have used in the 17th century. And at first I thought it was just a misspelling.
Yes.
And then I realized that it means, it's got another layer of meaning, which means they were savages, but they were people that needed to be salvaged. They needed to be saved. So it shows you the mindset. And I think language really reflects consciousness. And that's why I go to a lot of trouble to get the right word.
And spend maybe a lot of time in libraries or historical associations looking through what documents there are.
Reading writings from that time and place. So that time and place, these people, a lot of them had Wiltshire roots, so they use a lot of archaic Wiltshire dialect.
Oh, really?
And, you know, you have to use that sparingly or you're going to frustrate your reader. But if there is a lovely, resonant word, I definitely will try and use it.
And I know there was an archaeological dig at Harvard to sort of unearth, I guess, some of the artifacts left over.
Well, the interesting thing is that, as we know, Harvard, you know, might have been, had in its charter this wonderfully inclusive language, but for the couple of hundred years that was buried under 20 tons of white male privilege. And now, of course, Harvard has returned to its roots and is once more very actively trying to diversify its student body and is a needs-blind institution now and has a woman president, which I think would make Bethiah absolutely thrilled. And one of the parts of this reclaiming its history has been to relocate the Indian College, because this history was so lost, nobody even knew where the building stood. And so for the last 4 or so years, there's been an archaeological dig every summer and fall. And last time the dig was open, they managed to locate the foundation. So when it reopens this summer, they'll be able to go right down into the 17th century layer. And hopefully we'll learn more about the lives of these remarkable young scholars.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Geraldine Brooks is our guest. We are talking about a whole host of things and her new historical novel called Caleb's Crossing. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious, worried, on edge? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of worry and anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
Teens interested in journalism can use WHYY's production equipment to create news stories based on their interests during the Young Journalist Summer Camp. And for budding young filmmakers, the WHYY Film Academy teaches students to produce their own short films from script to screen. learn from professionals, express your ideas. Both camps are for students currently in 9th to 12th grade. Learn more at whyy.org/Hamilton Commons or 215-351-0511.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Texting while walking is causing pedestrians to slam into everything from cars to telephone poles to maybe you, but should it be outlawed? Also, one of the leaders of the Syrian opposition has his social media moment passed. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Geraldine Brooks about her new novel called Caleb's Crossing. It's set on Martha's Vineyard in the 17th century, and it's the story of a relationship between a young girl, Bethia Mayfield, the daughter of a minister on the island, and her friendship with Caleb, the son of a local chieftain. He is inspired by the true life of a young man on that island, Caleb, the first Native American to graduate from Harvard College going back to 1665. And we're talking about some of the characters and some of the descriptions in this book and some of the history as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You dedicate this book to one of your sons. You have two sons. Can you say his name for us?
Bazayo.
He's a son you adopted from Ethiopia.
That's right.
And you write, who also made a crossing.
Yeah.
Did you think about him as you were thinking about Caleb?
Very much, because I was working on this book when we brought Bizayo home 3 years ago now, and he didn't speak any English.
How old was he?
Five. He knew three other languages, however. And the rapidity with which he acquired English was just mind-blowing. In 3 months, he was fully fluent. In a year, he could read. And now, you know, he's only in the second grade. He reads at about a fifth grade level. And just watching the avidity of his acquisition of knowledge made me confident to write about Caleb being able to do the same thing. So I was very much looking at him and saying, yeah, of course. You know, it's plausible he learned English, Latin, and Greek, because I'm watching my own son do a very similar thing.
Where did you meet, or how did you know about Bizu?
Oh, we worked through an agency called Wide Horizons for Children, which is Massachusetts-based. I'd been in Ethiopia as a foreign correspondent and had a very great love for the people and the culture, and we had a great friend who was Ethiopian who I knew would be a great godmother for him. And so the program in Ethiopia is exemplary. It's run by the Ministry of Women's Affairs, and I think women do a very good job usually, and so it's totally transparent, and they're very on guard against any kind of the abuses that you can sometimes see in international adoption. So
how much did you know about him when he arrived?
Had a little tiny photograph.
That's
and
it?
A tiny little bit of history, but not much at all.
Amazing. So he's been with you, what, 4 years?
It's three years.
3 years.
Although, when I say that, I think that can't be right, because it's impossible to imagine our family without him now.
Let me get a couple of callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have, looks like, Andrew from Trenton. And Andrew, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I have a quick question for
sure.
Your guest. I had read or seen something years ago about the name, the original name of the island. And I recall it saying that the island was originally called Shelburne Island until a large fire, and then the name was changed to Martin's Vineyard or Martha's Vineyard sometime in the early 18th century. I wondered if your guest had run across that name.
I didn't. You know, I think it was Gosnold, who, you know, I'm really, it drives my husband crazy how bad I am at dates for somebody who writes historical fiction, but he was a very, very early traveler in that area, and he writes about the island as Martha's Vineyard at a very early point, so, and I haven't come across Shelburne Island in reference to it, no.
Andrew, okay. Yeah, no, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Can I get back to Bethia, and at She begins to work as an indentured servant, and you have some pretty vivid descriptions of what her life was like doing that. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that and how common that was at this time.
It was pretty common. You know, people would indenture their children for a variety of reasons. Sometimes if they couldn't look after them and provide nourishment, indenture was a way of at least providing that your kid would be fed and clothed and housed. So, you know, you're talking about a time where the mortality rate was off the charts. So just say, you know, a father lost the mother in childbirth and he had to work all the time and he couldn't care for his children, he would indenture them and they would work as household servants. Mm-hmm. And then as the century progresses, you find a lot of Native Americans, I think, being entrapped into indenture because the conflict between a private property system and the more communal ethos of Native Americans made it very easy for Native Americans to find themselves in some kind of murky debt. And then they would indenture their children in payment of that debt. And so Native American boys would go off on the whaling ships and they might be gone for 7 years and they would be out of their language and culture. And, you know, it had devastating effects.
And the idea that you have this sort of more capitalist system, I guess, that comes up against a very different kind of economic
in
system.
In the writings from the time, you see the English saying, I explained that I was buying the land, but I'm not sure that he understood it. He said to me, if I've said to you that you can build your house and hunt here, what more do you need? Mm. So it really was a completely conflicting worldview.
You also write, and I have to say I circled this because it's a phrase I'm not familiar with, and this is, again, going back to Bethia, where she talks about her quote-unquote ungirt, U-N-G-I-R-T, desire.
Oh, there's so many wonderful words in the Puritan documents of that time about all the different ways that you can sin, and ungirt desire was one, and, you know, the young men who are taking the hot waters in the taverns and, you know, what is small beer? Well, they had to drink small beer because there was no coffee or tea yet, which was, you know, we're pre that beverage. And yet the water is not healthy because people are tipping their night soil into the creeks and so forth. So everybody is drinking low alcohol beer, which is what we call small beer. But all these wonderful old words. One example I give is at one point she's learning something about midwifery and I needed her to talk about a fetus, but I was pretty sure she wouldn't have used the word fetus. So I consulted the Oxford thesaurus, historical thesaurus of the English language, and you can dig down all the way to Old English in that wonderful book, and in it you can find that in the mid-17th century the word for fetus was shapling.
Shapling, oh my goodness, wow.
And once you put the word shapling in her mouth, you're really in the 17th century, and that's very important to me.
And again, this word ungirt, mm-hmm. I mean...
A girt is a, you know, a girdle or a belt.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It reminds me of something like this. So something that's ungirt is released.
Loose. Right? Loose, yes. Yeah. And I actually can't remember whether I got that word from Anne Bradstreet's journal, or not journal, she didn't write a journal, but she makes reference to a period in her life when she's in love with the man who's about to be her husband, and it's total distraction for her, as it is. You know, she's very realistic about, you know, her human feelings, and she has to struggle. Or it might have been from the Harvard School rules, which were hilariously strict. And then when you go down to the dig, you find out that these rules were being disobeyed right and left, because it says no ostentatious or sumptuary decoration in clothing, and yet all these wonderfully engraved buttons and all kinds of fancy metals are coming up, and no smoking. Well, there are broken pipes everywhere, and no drinking hot waters, and there's all kinds of liquor bottles coming out of the dig. So, you know, they signed up for these rules, right, but they were breaking them. And, you know, as
and we shouldn't be surprised. I was going to say, that should not surprise us, right?
Yeah, nothing changes.
So what happened to the real Caleb? So he goes to Harvard College.
You know, I'm going to make you read the book to find out what happened to him. But I can tell you this, that towards the end of his studies, it seems that he is the protege of a very important figure, Thomas Danforth, who we probably know best from his role at the Salem witch trials, which came later. But he was a very noted jurist and a deputy governor of the colony, and he appears to have taken a great interest in Caleb. So I think, and I've assumed novelistically, that Caleb was being prepared to be a considerable man of affairs.
Wow.
And there's such a big what if here. If he had fulfilled that destiny, might he have been able to talk with Metacom and maybe forestalled King Philip's War, spoken to the governors of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and got a fairer dispensation for his people if he was being trained in the law?
Is that why you like historical novels, because of questions like that?
I think that those are, you know, I like them because I like the mystery of the void in the historical record. I think that human nature is to fill that void with empathy and to say, what would it be like to be them? And that's what draws me to it. But then I guess the journalist in me loves to puzzle out the pieces and say, well, what if? And just this week, actually, somebody contacted me about a deed that they have in Salem, and there are signatures on that deed of land transfer, and one of them is Caleb's. And right above it is Thomas Danforth. Oh, and wow. So it's sort of proving out my thesis a little bit that he was working very closely with Thomas Danforth and was not going to be a minister, maybe was going to be a legal figure.
And an intriguing idea, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like books like this satisfy both sides of your writing life, which is obviously the research that has to go into something like this.
Yeah, I like to let the story drive it, though. I mean, I don't do the gobs of research in advance. I research enough to hear the voices clearly and to know the architecture, perhaps the scaffolding of the story. Right. But then I let the character, the narrator, tell me what I need to know, because who she is tells me how she's going to act, and that drives the plot. And so then I learn what I need to go and find out.
And I've heard novelists talk that way about a narrator or about a character. Do you, though, have to hear her voice in order for her to be a real person?
Yeah, indeed. And unless somebody starts talking to me, I don't really have a book.
Oh.
And when I've told that to my sons, they go, oh, Mom's up there talking to ghosts again.
Can you share what your other son said about this book?
Well, my eldest son, Nathaniel, is 15, and he is a great reader, I am happy to say. He's the kind of kid who gets twitchy if he doesn't have a good book going. And he read this book when it was in manuscript, and he came and said, well, I like it, but I don't think it's your best work.
Oh, I see the a budding book critic, yes?
Maybe. Or maybe it was, I said, you know, when I pressed him more closely, he said he wanted more sex in it. So maybe it's just an adolescent boy thing.
I know that you have spent time on Martha's Vineyard, but as you say now, this is what, your home? This is where you live?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. And it's a marvelous place in so many ways. I mean, the physical beauty of the place is outstanding, and the historical and environmental stewardship of the island is remarkable, and the community is great and eccentric and wonderful, and in summer the whole world comes to us, so we don't really have to go anywhere.
Well, and do you want to go away when the world
No, it's not, it's not that long really, and it's kind of interesting, you know. It's nice to have a little bit of Washington, a little bit of Hollywood, knowing that they're all going to go.
She says with a smile. And do you have a certain way that you work? I mean, are you one of those very disciplined workers that, writers, I should say, that you know, make sure they sit down every day in front of their computer?
Oh, instance? Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think having been a journalist for so long really helps with that. I don't wait to get my aura on straight.
Oh, you don't?
No, I just wait for the school bus to go, and then I go to work. And basically, I got into the habit when the kids were younger of working just during the school day. And now I still do that, even though they don't, you know, for goodness sake, need me hovering over them every minute when they get home. But I found that that period of time works for me. And if I get up at that point and go and do other things, sometimes plot points resolve nicely while I'm turning the compost heap or walking the dog or whatever.
I mean, it sounds like it's a good place to write, at least a good place for you to write.
It's a wonderful place. You know, the winter is much quieter, and you can really get down that rabbit hole that's necessary for novel writing, I think.
And can you pull yourself out when the kids come
home? You have to. I mean, somebody's got to get their food on the table. I mean, I've always, you know, I always resented that line about the baby carriage in the hall is the enemy of great writing. And then Anne Enright, the novelist, nailed it. She said, the baby carriage in the hall is not the enemy of great writing. It's the enemy of great drinking.
And is there great drinking on Martha's Vineyard in the middle of that really cold and long winter?
Oh, look, there can be. There can be. But, you know, if you've got to get up for the school schedule, it's a limit. And so that's, you know, I think that's what is very true. And I actually find being in the kids' world helpful because their relationship with imagination is so vivid. And also reading kids' fiction, I'm a huge fan of it because plot is crucial to it, and it's not like adult literary fiction where you approach plot with some embarrassment as if it's a hair in the soup or something. And I often found myself, you know, I'd be reading something that's full of ideas and X leads inexorably to Y, with X being something interesting and Y being something even more interesting in the books I was reading to my kids. And then I'd go and pick up my luminous, liminal, little adult literary fiction. And oh, I want to go back to Philip Pullman.
There you go. Do you miss journalism?
Sometimes, yeah. I miss being engaged in the world, and particularly now I think we're so distracted by so many things and failing to reflect on the elephant in the room, which to me is climate change. And I think we'll look back on this time and think, what was with them? Were they quite mad?
Mm. Well, on that note, Geraldine Brooks, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. It's been a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Maddie.
You're very welcome. And her new novel is called Caleb's Crossing. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can even see what she looks like. We'll put it on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.